Todd is going to be talking about his ongoing research on his dissertation proposal about pipeline, contentious pipeline politics. Do you have a thing, or are you just talking? All right, I'm going to just duck out and check to see how long we have the room to make sure that I can see how long the conversation can go. But I will turn the floor over to Mohan.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I acknowledge the sacred land on which the University of Toronto operates. This land has been the site of human activity for 15,000 years. This land is the territory of the Huron, Wendat, and Petun First Nations, the Seneca, and most recently the Mississauga of the Credit River. This territory was the subject of the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, an agreement between the Iroquois Confederacy and Confederacy of the Ojibwe and allied nations to peaceably share and care for the resources around the Great Lakes. Today, the meeting place of Toronto is still the home to many Indigenous peoples from across Turtle Island, and I am grateful to have the opportunity to work on this territory. So I have three purposes today, to provide an outline on my proposed research questions and methodology, which you should have received a handout about by email. Second, to discuss each briefly, as well as case selection and general thoughts on implementing the project. And third, I would particularly appreciate practical suggestions about how to carry out the proposed network analysis in terms of identifying and approaching research subjects and undertaking field work. So background on me, I did my undergrad at UBC and an MPhil in International Relations in Oxford before going to work for the federal government for 5 years. I'm now a fifth-year PhD student. I'm being supervised by Andrew Olive and Kate Neville, and Peter Russell and Joseph Cairns are also on my committee. This project grew in part from my experience with the 2011 Keystone XL protests in Washington, D.C. So the Keystone XL pipeline was proposed in 2006 and would run from Hardisty, Alberta to Nederland, Texas, which is close to Houston on the Gulf of Mexico, and it would have a capacity of 830,000 barrels per day of diluted bitumen. As people I'm sure have seen, it provoked a substantial and widely noted resistance campaign. More than 80,000 news stories on Google News mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline. Northern Gateway was proposed in 2008 and would run from Bruderheim, Alberta to Kitimat, British Columbia, on sort of the central coast of BC. It would be 525,000 barrels per day, and it's featured substantially in BC and federal electoral politics, and there are some really central Indigenous issues as well. So why do I think Keystone XL and Northern Gateway are plausible as comparative cases? First, I think there's comparative value in considering the different jurisdictions that are involved, in one case only in Canada, the other crossing the U.S. boundary, and also in terms of state and provincial politics. In terms of time, I think each is historical enough now that we can look at the process with some context. It's not as ongoing as, say, the Dakota Access Pipeline or what's happening this very day on Kinder Morgan, but it's recent enough that I think it's plausible to find interview subjects for the network analysis, and people will have a fairly clear recollection of how they've been involved. I think the two cases connect to theories that are expressed in the existing literature, people like Karen Litvin and George Hoberg's analysis, which is largely focused on institutional context and veto points. And another way in which I think they're interesting is tankers, that the further export via tanker has been a really central part of the discussion about the Northern Gateway pipeline, but not the Keystone XL pipeline. So in terms of the so what of this project, the motivation is less about what happens specifically with these two pipelines, and it's more about how fossil fuel energy development is being contested with a new level of energy and determination because of what we're learning from climate science. And this is raising the stakes. Pipeline projects aren't just about who will suffer from spills or immediate effects. Just this Monday, 99 young activists were arrested in Ottawa protesting a pipeline that would be in British Columbia. Big political changes are happening, and activist movements are, if not representing, at least engaged in the leading edge of those changes. And questions like, how do we reconcile theories of social justice with the critiques of politics environmentalists make? And how are the core beliefs of activist actors changing? There are two case studies in terms of pipelines, and then there are two groups within the movement that I'm hoping to sort of oversample. The first of them is faith communities. I was surprised by the scale of faith group representation in the 2011 Keystone XL protests. Members of church groups who traveled across the country to get arrested together, prominent religious figures, monks in religious attire getting arrested. Churches have also been heavily involved in the fossil fuel divestment movement, as well as with the ongoing process of Indigenous reconciliation in Canada. For instance, the involvement of the Anglican and United Churches in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Finally, in terms of faith communities, I've found so far that it's a tightly linked and communicative community that I think is particularly well suited to this network analysis approach. In terms of Indigenous communities, I think that perhaps the most important evolving relationship in climate politics is between environmental activists and Indigenous peoples. This is motivated in part by the special legal status of Indigenous peoples, including under Canadian constitutional law and the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But it also involves important normative challenges to environmentalism, particularly this historical form that's largely rooted in animal rights and which either has little concern, which probably has little concern about culture and arguably about poverty as well. So you should have seen my list of research questions. They're essentially evaluating the anti-KXL and anti-NGP movements on three levels: in terms of the human geography and the network between groups that are involved, in terms of their thinking on strategies and tactics. For instance, there are groups like the Citizens Climate Lobby that's focused on nonpartisan lobbying of decision makers, and then there are groups that do civil disobedience or nonviolent direct action. And then thirdly, in terms of the evolution and mutual interaction between the beliefs of core participants. Very briefly, in terms of epistemology, I want to sort of comment on the intellectual philosophy behind this. I see our ability to understand politics as a natural outgrowth of the study of history. That's not to suggest that politics has somehow superseded the subject of history, but rather that what distinguishes the study of politics is largely how it has political and normative motivations. We look at the events of history to identify useful patterns, and we want to study contemporary politics, at least in part because it has consequences which we consider normatively important. So the consequences of this perspective for the project are, first, an emphasis on collecting primary source historical materials, particularly first-hand accounts from people personally involved in political activity. So there's a motivation not only to document the major axes of disagreement among climate change activists and interpret those disagreements in light of relevant literatures in politics, ethics, and other disciplines, but also consider hypotheses about how the core beliefs of politically influential groups might become sufficiently aligned to achieve climate change mitigation outcomes compatible with the sub-2-degree Celsius warming scenario from the UNFCCC and subsequent discussions. So there are kind of five areas of practicalities that I want to highlight. First, there are several challenges involved in conducting this research ethically and in keeping with the Tri-Council policy statement on ethical conduct for research involving humans, the three main principles of which are respect for persons, concern for welfare, and justice. This derives from the 1978 Belmont Report, which had the three principles of respect for persons, beneficence, and justice. Very briefly, some of those concerns are people who are members of disadvantaged communities, and also it's a matter of public record that police and intelligence services are doing their own network analysis of climate change activist groups, which raises some questions about data protection and subject protection and consent, etc. Second practicality, I can't actually begin a lot of this network analysis before I have ethical clearance, so I can only speculate about whether anyone will want to talk to me. Thirdly, my hope is to do a first round of interviews remotely by telephone and Skype, but ultimately to do an in-person research trip from the Gulf of Mexico to the bitumen sands and then to the BC coast and the Haida Gwaii. So is it plausible to undertake a single research trip from Texas to the Haida Gwaii, which I would expect to take probably 2 months or more? By Greyhound. Practicality number four, what suggestions do people have about identifying and approaching interview subjects? And finally, has anyone worked with large amounts of audio and transcripts and transcribing? And if so, do you have any advice on things you wish you'd known before you started? Thank you.
Great. All right. Questions?